Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Shock in Washington today as Eric Cantor, the young gun who soared to the top of Republican congressional leadership, has gone down in defeat to his Tea Party primary challenger, Dave Brat, in Virginia. The House majority leader losing in a near rout. This is as rare as Halley's Comet in Washington. It's a huge win for the Tea Party, a big shakeup for the GOP establishment with all kinds of implications. 2014, 2016. This hour on Point, Eric Cantor's defeat and what it may mean. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's the message in Cantor's loss for the GOP? For the country, Virginians, what happened here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Eric Cantor in his concession speech last night.
I know there's a lot of long faces here tonight, and it's disappointing, sure. But I believe in this country. I believe there's opportunity around the next corner for all of us.
But not an opportunity in the U.S. House of Representatives for the majority leader right now. Here's David Brat, who won the primary in Virginia's 7th District.
We believe in God who gave us this miracle today, and we believe in the faith of the founders, and we believe that that faith and that strong moral fiber is necessary for the continuation of our republic as it stands. And I truly believe that.
Huge upset. We're going to look at this from every angle today. Joining me first from Richmond, Virginia, Jeff Shapiro, reporter and columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. He's been covering Virginia politics for 30 years. Jeff, welcome to On Point. What happened here out on the hustings, Jeff?
Well, a lot of people are saying that Dave Brat is the new face, the strange face, the unusual face. And I'm wondering if perhaps some of those appellations might be affixed to Eric Cantor. Mr. Cantor represented this district in the central Virginia conservative heartland for 14 years, and of course, quickly scaling the greasy pole of power. And as he did, his constituents saw less and less of him. The perception has been, certainly in Washington, as well as in the Richmond area, that the congressman seemed more interested in positioning for the next phase of the nonstop news cycle than perhaps pushing through a substantive policy-based agenda in the House.
We read that he raised more than $5 million for this race, Eric Cantor, that he spent over $2 million, that Brat spent maybe $100,000, $200,000. We read that Eric Cantor spent more at steakhouses than Brat spent on his whole campaign. What about the money differential and what it came down to, Jeff?
Well, I think there were a lot of people, perhaps myself included, who believed that financial and technological edge, as well as the presumed advantages of incumbency, would certainly help Mr. Cantor to renomination. And I suspect as well that Mr. Brat and his people were not anticipating a victory as much as the possibility is deeply embarrassing the congressman and perhaps derailing his reach for the speakership. But getting back to this point about Cantor and his positioning, it was never really clear where he stood. I think it's safe to say that Eric Cantor is a business class, for the most part, centrist Republican, not interested in a lot of this hot button stuff, primarily focusing on lower taxes, lighter regulation. It became increasingly difficult for him to maintain this balancing act between his preferred priorities and what this growing right-wing presence demanded the longer he was in the leadership.
And Jeff Shapiro, finally, what about the polling? I mean, here's a, 55 to 44 or something like that loss by leader Cantor. What about the polling in advance of this? What did it miss?
Well, I think it's important to point out that in a primary, traditionally a lightly attended primary, the fewer votes, often the bigger the surprises. And That, I believe, is what we saw in the 7th District of Virginia last night.
And it's a done deal. Eric Cantor defeated in a primary. Everybody thought he would win. Jeff Shapiro, thanks for getting us up close to some of the reasons why, for joining us from Richmond today. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for including me.
Here's Dave Bratt last night describing why he won the primary.
It's about returning the country to constitutional principles. It's about returning the country to Judeo-Christian principles. And it's about returning this country to free market principles where no one is favored.
And it's about dismaying Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill. With us now from Washington, and we're so glad to have him, Ken Rudin, big political watcher, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, welcome back to On Point. How rare is this, Ken?
Well, Tom, in your introduction, you said it's about as rare as Halley's Comet. I think Halley's Comet is much more common than this. A majority leader, a House majority leader, has never, majority whip, has never, ever in history ever lost in a party primary. I mean, it's funny. We were all prepared. We knew about the Tea Party. We knew what the Tea Party did in 2010 and 2012. And we were saying, well, we have to watch Mitch McConnell because they're out to get Mitch McConnell. They're out to get John Boehner. They're even out to get Lindsey Graham, who ran yesterday in South Carolina. Nobody, including Eric Cantor, paid attention to what was going on in Virginia's 7th District.
And here he is out on his ear. Could he have been completely blindsided by this? Could he have not seen this coming?
Well, if he did, he saw it only in the last couple of weeks. About a month ago, or maybe less than that, his choice for a Republican chairman of a county that he represents got defeated by Bratt's campaign choice. So there was disgruntlement, definitely. And so that was out there. But, I mean, as Jeff Shapiro said, he had $5 million. I mean, you know, there was no money at all for Bratt. It's my understanding that Rob Lowe and Molly Ringwald were heading up his pack. That would be the Bratt pack. I'm sorry, but no, there was just no question about it. And we were all focused on Lindsey Graham. Eric Cantor was measuring the drapes because John Boehner was going to leave soon as Speaker. And what was the expectation? And I think what was so interesting is two things. One, this means that nobody is safe. If Eric Cantor, with the financial advantage, his own polls apparently had him up by 25 points. If he's not safe, then nobody's safe. And two, what does it say about the national Tea Party groups? Because nobody came in for the national Tea Party groups, came in to help Dave Bratt. It was just local grassroots efforts. Laura Ingraham had him on her radio show and talked him up, but there was no national involvement at all. You talk about surprises, and we like to think that we know everything that's going to happen. We were all shocked by what happened last night.
Well, I mean, there was some of that, as you say, conservative radio talk show host support for him. This was June 4th, just a few days ago. Laura Ingraham cracking a joke at Eric Cantor's expense about who ought to have been traded for American POW Bo Bergdahl.
Maybe, you know, for getting Sergeant Bergdahl out of captivity, instead of sending like 5 Taliban MVPs over there, he could have just traded 1 Eric Cantor.
Yeah. Laura Ingraham at a rally for David Bratt, who won that primary election. Where the ferocity of opposition to Cantor? I mean, after all, he was very highly placed. If that counts on bringing home the bacon or you name it, he'd been there 14 years for this district. So why this turnaround, Ken?
Well, Dave Bratt was saying up and down, going up and down the district. I mean, he had no money. There were no campaign commercials. He really was word of mouth and talk radio. But he said that Eric Cantor had become Wall Street, and we really care about Main Street. He became Wall Street. That sounds like an Elizabeth Warren campaign ad, actually, yeah. When you think of it.
Yeah.
But and he also talked about that the immigration overhaul. Nobody thinks that Eric Cantor was the liberal link in the Republican leadership in the House. He was far more conservative than John Boehner. As a matter of fact, he was thought to be stopping John Boehner's efforts for reaching out about immigration overhaul. He was the one who was trying to hold him back. But wherever Bratt went, he said it was amnesty. He was Cantor was helping to open up the borders. And the combination of that with his collusion with Wall Street bankers really just did him in.
Ken, what about knock-on effects here? What does this mean for other races? What does this mean for Republican leadership for 2014, 2016?
Well, it certainly probably gives a signal, not that they needed a signal to begin with, but it gives signal to many Republican lawmakers that you deal with Democrats and talk about conciliation with the opposite side and reaching across the aisle at your own peril. And what it says about immigration overhaul, that's another story altogether. I mean, if everybody thinks this is the reason why there won't be immigration overhaul, there could have been lots of reasons. John Boehner over and over again kept saying, well, we'd like to have a deal, but this came up. Well, I'd like to trust President Obama, but the Bergdahl deal came up. So if we can't trust him on Bergdahl, if we can't trust him on carbon emissions, how can we trust him on immigration? So there was always an excuse about immigration, but it's hard to see anybody willing to pass anything anymore and work with the other side. And that could go on not only through 2014, but perhaps until and through the 2016 presidential election.
Some Democrats are celebrating the revival of Tea Party prospects here, saying it's tough on Republican national aspirations. What do you say to that, Ken?
Well, there's truth to that, because it is, I think one of the reasons this was such a shock is that there keeps being a dynamic about whether the Tea Party is up, whether it's down. Mm-hmm. When Mitch McConnell won big, it said, well, the Tea Party is dead. When Lindsey Graham was doing really well in the polls, well, the Tea Party is ineffective. And then you have something like this happening and you say, well, wait a second, maybe the Tea Party is there all along. So ultimately, I think the narrative about the establishment winning was false, and we learned it last night.
Ken Rudin, it's great to have you with us. Let's talk again soon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the stunning upset primary defeat of House Majority Leader Republican Eric Cantor. He's headed out, defeated by a Tea Party opponent in Virginia, looking at power in politics being shaken in Washington right now. Here's Eric Cantor last night giving his concession speech.
Serving as a 7th District Congressman and then having the privilege to be Majority Leader has been one of the highest honors of my life. And, what I set out to do and what the agenda that I have always said we're about is we want to create a Virginia and an America that works for everybody.
If that was the message that came across, it wasn't what some voters, a majority, wanted to hear. Here's David Bratt talking to his supporters in his victory celebration last night.
When I go to D.C., every vote I take will move the pendulum in the direction of the people away from Washington, D.C., back to the states, back to the localities, and back to you.
We've heard from Richmond. Let's go to Washington. Amy Walter is with us, national editor of the Cook Political Report, joining us from Washington. Amy, thanks very much for being here today.
Sure, happy to, Tom.
And Nancy Cordes joins us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, thanks so much for taking time to join us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Nancy, so here you guys are in one of the biggest House primary earthquakes of all time, the lead on your story. Put this in historical perspective for us, Amy.
This hasn't happened, ever. I mean, if you look back historically, the closest thing I think people talked about something like this happening in 1899, not many of us were around then.
Not many.
So this is not something that you see all that often. Obviously, a House leadership person knocked off. Now, look, we know that he had a race. We were paying attention to the fact that he had a race, but it looked like, based both on the polling, the amount of money being spent, and what we were hearing from those in the Cantor camp, that he had this under control. He was very much ahead. And the fact that so many other so-called establishment Republicans had survived their primaries with a similar trouncing of their opponents. Their polls mm-hmm. looked good going in. They'd spent the right amount of money. They paid attention to the race. The expectation was that Eric Cantor was going to win pretty easily. And what we found, of course, was that he actually was not just defeated, but trounced in an election where you had much higher turnout than I think anybody expected, certainly than the Cantor folks expected.
Nancy, granular from your perspective for a minute, this is Dave Saunders, and this is a Democrat in Virginia, but he's saying the talk was that his constituent services suck. He tweeted or wrote here. He was never in the district. When he was, he had a security entourage with him, seen as gallivanting all over the country being a big deal, and this is a lesson. Is this a lesson that the establishment Republican comeback is not working? Is this a lesson that it's hard to be a national Republican figure and stay closely in touch with your home constituents? What do you see here, Nancy?
All of the above, Tom. I think that it shows the challenges of being a top leader in either party. Because he was traveling a lot, both nationally and internationally, he was raising a lot of money for other Republican candidates because he believed that he was so safe in his own home district. And he was also taking positions on every major issue, which is something that you have to do when you're a leader. You have to sort of guide your troops one way or the other, and often that puts you in a position where you're at odds with the grassroots of your party. And recently he had been at odds. He voted for raising the debt ceiling, for example. He was in favor of some limited immigration reform. And you saw a candidate run as a purer version of Eric Cantor, essentially saying we shouldn't be compromising on these things. And when you're in a Republican primary with a fraction of the Republican electorate coming out to vote, you have the most impassioned voters coming out, the ones who are most unhappy with the status quo. And it looks like not only did Cantor get taken off guard, but even Bratt was surprised by his own victory.
Let's hear right from that district, Richmond, Virginia. Scott is calling. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think part of it has to do with three things. One, I think a lot of people in the district are tired of Eric Cantor in that he often appears to be in it only for himself as opposed to really doing things to help his constituents. A second thing is, and I'm not sure if this is unique to Virginia, but Virginia has an open primary, which means that anybody who votes can vote for either slate, whether you're a Republican and you want to vote for a Democratic candidate or you're a Democrat and you want to vote for a Republican candidate.
What are you saying, Scott? You think Democrats elected Dave Bratt?
Well, Ben Jones was publicly encouraging that last week. I think that certainly could have an impact, especially when you have such a low turnout throughout the district. Another factor, Jamie Radke, who had opposed George Allen for the Republican nod for the senatorial campaign last year, was a big Dave Bratt supporter and worked her tail off to help Bratt's campaign.
Scott, we've got it. There's the word from Richmond, right in Cantor's district, soon to be Dave Bratt's district. Amy Walter, what about crossover voters? I'm reading here that they didn't come out in such numbers.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting theory, and he's exactly right. You know, Virginia is a state you don't register by party. You can just walk into the voting booth as long as you're a registered voter and pick up the ballot of either side, Democrat or Republican. But some smart folks right on election night had been doing some number crunching, and what they found was if you went into the most Democratic precincts in his district, the turnout was really pretty abysmal. Where Eric Cantor lost was in heavily Republican areas of the district. He lost among Republicans. And I think one thing we have to remember, too, is the amount of national attention that was being brought to bear in this race. Folks like Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham really encouraging folks to turn out. So you had that added momentum the weekend before the election. And I also think you put on top of that the fact that there's actually talk of a government shutdown in Virginia, where Richmond, of course, is the state capital. Mm-hmm. More for voters in that district, another reminder of just how frustrated they are with politics as usual could have been another factor encouraging higher than what we thought would be typical turnout.
And money didn't decide this one.
No,
winner
not.
Dave Bratt, happy to celebrate that last night.
The reason we won this campaign, there's just one reason, and that's because dollars do not vote. You do.
Remember that line. You may hear it again. The news out that Eric Cantor's campaign spent $168,000 at steakhouses. Bratt spent $200,000 overall in this campaign. Nancy Cordes, take us to Capitol Hill and the ramifications of this Cantor defeat. What is it likely to mean?
Well, the jockeying has already started, not just for his plum spot as the House Majority Leader, but also for his mantle as the heir apparent to the Speaker of the House, because many people here on Capitol Hill assume that Speaker Boehner won't be sticking around all that much longer, that he has sent signals that he'd like to retire sometime soon. And so just Just today, Congressman Pete Sessions of Texas told CBS News that he is indeed throwing his hat into the ring for House Majority Leader, that he believes that it's all about immigration, and that he thinks the number one thing that we need to do is secure the borders. He feels he's already got support from other members, and I think you're going to see more of that over the next couple of days. Of course, Eric Cantor is still the House Majority Leader at this point, and one thing that we don't know is whether he will relinquish that spot right away, whether he'll wait a while. I mean, he is still in Congress until the end of the year, so he could try to hold on to it. And leaders, including him and the Speaker, are going to be huddling today trying to figure out what to do, because this caught the Speaker off guard as well, and he's going to want a number two who supports him, who is like-minded. But conservatives in the House may have other ideas. They've always been frustrated that they don't feel like they have one of their own in leadership. Excuse me. Eric Cantor many times came out in support of their issues. He was a really early defender of the Tea Party, arguing for their agenda, but for some reason he was never completely embraced by them, and we saw him moving away from them a bit over the past 6 months or so, and that may be part of the reason that the Tea Party became disenchanted with him.
Amy, what's your analysis of why the Tea Party never fully embraced Eric Cantor? There were many times for the cameras that his rhetoric seemed to line up just about perfectly with theirs.
Well, and you've seen him sort of evolve over the last 4 or 5 years. You know, back in the 2010 era, he was the one who was actually to the right of Speaker Boehner.
Yeah. Right?
There was that work between Boehner and the president on getting a so-called deal, grand bargain on the budget.
Yep.
It was Cantor, really, who helped to scuttle that. So what you've seen, though, over the last about year is Eric Cantor really trying to move the party not into an entirely different direction, but to move it from being the party that was just the party of no. We're against everything that Democrats and the president are about, to a party of yes. What are we for? Really, an agenda that was forward-looking. As Nancy pointed out, immigration reform in some manner being part of that. But I think it really, when you look at the base of the Republican Party, this is the biggest struggle for Republicans in leadership, is the fact that the base of the party believes that compromise is a dirty word. They, more than liberals, more than moderate Republicans, more than any other group of voters, conservative Republicans, Tea Party Republicans, really, really dislike the idea of compromising. And when you are in leadership, that is what you are supposed to do. So he was really in an absolutely no-win situation here. If he just had moved the party on the Tea Party track, which is don't compromise, don't compromise, don't compromise, we saw what happened. Government shut down. Republicans' approval rating dropped. There was talk even about Democrats being able to pick up seats in the House. This was a disaster for the Republican Party nationally. But for the Republican base, it's exactly what they want.
Joe in Melbourne, Florida. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm sorry. I have a different take on this entirely. The polls showed that Cantor was so far ahead that I imagine an awful lot of Republicans woke up this morning in shock, thinking that their vote wouldn't have counted. The polls showed Cantor so far ahead. Why would I get out of bed or take the time to vote? I think this is a good example of a horrific get-out-the-vote effort on the part of Mr. Cantor. But this conversation and what I'm seeing nationally on the news, that this is a resurgence of Tea Party, I don't think the numbers demonstrate that. I think there's going to be an awful lot of hand-wringing when the press and the media start looking underneath the vote and what happened.
Joe, that's a very interesting perspective. Let us pick it up, a kind of wag-the-dog theory here, that the more establishment voters just didn't get out of bed. Hardcore base did, and David Bratt took it away. Nancy Cordes, what about it?
I think he's right on. I mean, Eric Cantor won his primary 2 years ago with 80% of the vote. So everyone, including Cantor, was not that worried this time around. In fact, the Washington Post has reported that he was not even in his home district on Election Day. He was in Washington meeting with fundraisers.
Maybe it doesn't matter, Nancy. He lost. He's out. Is it going to send the same signal anyway? Joe says, you know, hey, don't get all wrapped up in the hand-wringing about Tea Party one way or another, but Eric Cantor's gone, whatever the reason for that defeat, Nancy.
Well, I think what this shows is not that the Tea Party is resurgent or that it's waning, but that it is there and it is a force. And in specific races, Tea Party candidates have momentum. They have a lot of excitement. They have a lot of energy from the base. But I think we have to be careful not to draw a huge national lesson from this one race. As Larry Sabato, who's a longtime Virginia political expert, put it to us, this had a lot to do with Eric Cantor himself and the fact that, as Sabato put it, his ambition is white hot. Everyone knew for years that he wanted to be the Speaker of the House. Almost everything he's done has been geared towards that end. And unfortunately, as Sabato put it, it has caused him to flip-flop, to go back and forth a lot. Sometimes he's moderate, sometimes he's conservative, sometimes he's with the Tea Party, sometimes he's against them. And Sabato argues that his image, even in his home district, became kind of fuzzy because he tried at times to be all things to all people.
So it comes down to personal elements. But, Amy, whether there's a national lesson here or not, surely this looks like it may, as you say, stop a lot of whatever compromise might have been in the winds. Right. Could be stopped in its tracks.
Look, when you talk to so-called establishment Republicans, they get so frustrated because they say, you know, there's so much worrying and so much overinterpreting of every one of these contests. Very few incumbents lose. This was an outlier, not a typical experience in this primary cycle. Mitch McConnell won easily, for example, but it has a chilling effect because every single member of the House is right now thinking, if Eric Cantor can lose, of course I can lose too. It says, now as you're seeing the leadership race, what it also says is to folks who are thinking about running for leader or voting for leader is, I guess then, the kind of person we need in leadership is someone who does not have to worry about being ousted in a primary. We need the most conservative person we can get, which in the short term, that's going to be good for the Tea Party Republicans, most conservative Republicans in the party. But it is not good in the long term for the National Republican Party. Their problem is not keeping control of the House. Their problem is winning the Electoral College. And what is keeping them from winning the Electoral College is they are increasingly being seen as a regional conservative party that does not that is not broadening in any way. And this loss of Eric Cantor is only going to make that worse. It's only going to exacerbate that problem.
He's lost. How long can Eric Cantor stay in his House Majority Leader spot there, Amy? I mean, he's a lame duck.
Yeah, I mean, Nancy will probably be more on top of this. Sure. She's right up there on the Hill right now. I know that they're all sort of meeting now to see what happens next. But yeah, it's a very awkward place to be right now if you're the majority leader. And I think there are a whole bunch of people, not surprisingly, who are already quietly or not so quietly positioning themselves to run.
How many days do you give him, Nancy? 550?
Well, I think the first thing we have to find out is whether he intends to mount a write-in campaign. I think that's unlikely. Mm-hmm. It would be very difficult. It could end up splitting the Republican vote and allowing the Democrat in that district to win, which would be very unusual since the district is about 60% Republican. But I suppose it could happen. He could decide he wants to go that route. So he's certainly not going to step down until he decides those sorts of issues. And then beyond that, I think it's going to be a decision that he makes in conjunction with the Speaker. You know, the Speaker may want to let things sort of die down for a couple of days so there isn't some kind of crazy free-for-all.
Nancy, hold the thought right there. We'll come back to it after a short break. And Nancy Cordes with CBS News, Amy Walter with Cook Political Report. Thanks so much for joining us, Amy.
Sure. Happy to.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the stunning upset primary defeat of House Majority Leader Republican Eric Cantor. He's headed out, defeated by a Tea Party opponent in Virginia. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. We'll go to the Tea Party in just a moment. Here's Eric Cantor. This is from his concession speech last night, talking about his conservative agenda.
We need to focus our efforts as conservatives, as Republicans, on putting forth our conservative solutions so that they can help solve the problems for so many working middle class families that may not have the opportunity that we have.
Eric Cantor there hinting at his recent flirtation with reform conservatives looking to bring a middle class agenda. We talked with him just last week on this show. Yuval Levin, Peter Winter for the GOP. Didn't help him in his primary yesterday. With us right now from Washington, Matt Kibbe, president and CEO of FreedomWorks, conservative libertarian lobbying group, Washington, heavily associated with the Tea Party movement. One of the masterminds, he's called, of Tea Party politics. Matt Kibbe, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well. How do you, from Tea Party country, interpret this defeat of Eric Cantor, the victory of David Brett?
You know, we've been talking for years about the disintermediation of politics and the way that grassroots activists with social media and multiple sources of information have better tools to beat the old rules of politics. And I think you just saw that play out big time last night in Virginia, where, you know, all the money and all the power in Washington and all of your friends in D.C. don't help you against an authentic challenger combined with a grassroots turnout machine. And I think this isn't just about the Tea Party. It's not just about the civil war within the Republican Party. I think this is a national trend that's affecting both parties. It's disrupting the way the old rules played out.
Is there a civil war in the GOP? And if so, after yesterday's vote, who's winning?
Well, I think there is. There's very much, I'd call it the lobbying class of the GOP versus the grassroots. And clearly last night that the grassroots won that fight. There was obviously an element of surprise to it. And it may be one of the lessons from yesterday is when the leadership and all of the advantages of incumbency, when they see you coming, it's more difficult to beat them with a grassroots campaign because, you know, in a place like Kentucky where Mitch McConnell spent $10 million mm-hmm. in a relatively small media market, that's pretty hard to beat.
So to the establishment Republicans who have put a target on the Tea Party and gone after your primary candidates across the country very deliberately this time, what do you say today, Matt?
Well, I think we should sit down and figure out how the GOP authentically represents the ideas that it claims to represent. What is their plan to both repeal Obamacare and replace it with a serious set of reforms? What are they going to do to balance the budget? Because they run on these things. But clearly last night, the message from the grassroots was your leadership is failing. You're not getting it done. We need to send somebody new.
Nancy, there on Capitol Hill, how do you think this will play out vote by vote, issue by issue? Will we see a further retreat from any kind of openness to, you know, discussing across party lines? Does this freeze that, even though there may be this reason or that reason for the loss?
Yes, although in fairness, not that much talking was going on anyway.
Yeah.
So you may not see too much of a difference. I do think that immigration reform, which was mostly dead, is now all the way dead, at least this year. There had been some talk that perhaps it could be resurrected in the lame duck session after the midterm elections. I think that becomes less likely. You wonder who on the Republican side would stand up for immigration reform in the House, at least right now. You do have in the Senate Republicans still arguing that something needs to be done. Lindsey Graham, who won his contested primary, a senator from South Carolina, still says that he thinks that immigration reform needs to happen. But I think in the House, the overwhelming answer among Republicans is no, it doesn't. And I think that this is going to cause yet again a sort of reshuffling of the Republican agenda, because you saw back in November, December, after the government shutdown, when Republicans took such a beating in public opinion, Speaker Boehner kind of reasserting himself over the conservative wing of his party and saying, look, there are forces out there, conservative groups that are trying to mislead the public into thinking that we as a party can do things that we can't, can accomplish things that we can't, and they are not looking out for the best interests of the party. And he sort of seemed to regain some sway over that group and some authority. Now I think you're going to see a reshuffling again, and they're going to definitely be feeling their oats and feeling like they need to push him back in their direction.
Eric Cantor had shown a glimmer of openness to doing something on immigration. Here he was just, this is not so long ago, May 28th, interviewed here by Fox News, talking about some points on his ideas for immigration reform. You can hear his kind of openness here.
I believe in doing something for the kids who've been brought here, unbeknownst to them in most instances. I've always said we need to do something on the border to make sure that our law starts right there at the border.
So tough there at the end, but something for the kids, a kind of an allusion to the DREAM Act and some of that. Met Kibbe over the weekend, last week, Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham, playing up this what we've seen, this influx of child immigrants at the border. We've talked about it on this show, saying that's evidence of that President Obama's 2012 moratorium on deporting young illegals had spurred this influx. Cantor had shown support for the DREAM Act. What about immigration and his Cantor's openness to something here? Is that a third rail, Matt?
I don't think openness to immigration reform is a third rail. I think my criticism of Cantor and other Republicans is how reactionary they are, always responding to the president's agenda, always responding to Harry Reid's agenda. I think the way you solve problems from immigration reform to balancing the budget is actually putting your own ideas on the table first. Compromise is when you have two sets of ideas and probably competing ideas with different priorities actually put on the table. And I think that the great frustration that you're seeing is that the Republican leadership in the House, we haven't gotten that. What is exactly their alternative to Obamacare? How are they going to stop it? And they were critical of our efforts to defund Obamacare, knowing that it was going to be a train wreck, but they didn't have an alternative plan. And I don't think we're trying to stop legislative progress. What we would like is a serious set of ideas that are translated into legislative actual language and then going to the table saying, this is what we're fighting for. They haven't done that.
Nancy Cordes, Politico, out with a story saying for Jewish Republicans, oy vey, sort of slapping the forehead. Here was the highest ranking, certainly in the House, and one of the few overall on Capitol Hill. And now he's out. We've got some Twitter traffic today. Jonathan Weissman, New York Times, and others, referencing that this may have been an issue somehow in this campaign, after all the election campaigns Eric Cantor's run in Virginia. What about, we heard Dave Bratt talking about the Judeo-Christian tradition. What about Eric Cantor's religion? A factor here or not?
It may have been, but I think it's more than that. I think that as his district changed and became more rural, he may have been out of step with the district for a variety of reasons. He may have seemed more like a buttoned-up city type, and he had a lot of rural voters. It could be things like that. But certainly, yes, he was the only House Republican who was Jewish. It was an anomaly. Jews overwhelmingly tend to vote Democratic, so you do lose some diversity there, but I would be surprised if Cantor himself would say, I lost this race because I'm Jewish.
Blaine in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Blaine, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, as a Main Street conservative here in Massachusetts, I disagree with the notion that Mr. Cantor losing and hopefully Thad Cochran losing in his runoff, that it's bad for presidential elections for Republicans.
Thad Cochran, who, of course, in Mississippi is also up against a Tea Party challenger. You welcome this, Blaine?
I do. If you look at the last few presidential elections, the Republican candidate has really been Democrat light, so I'm really excited about seeing conservative ideas being proudly represented and letting them be debated out in the public forum rather than being bashed. So I think it's a good development.
Bring it on. No Democrat light candidates for the presidency. What about it? You know, Matt Kibbe, we've got Representative Peter King, Republican, of course, from New York, saying the results tonight will move the party further to the right, which will marginalize us further as a national party. Our caller just now saying he'd like to see that move to the right. How do you read those national political ramifications, Matt?
Well, I think I agree with the caller. I think Republicans win elections when they differentiate the product that they're offering with what the Democrats offered. And you're seeing that play out in Mississippi. Thad Cochran is running on his ability to bring spending earmarks back to the state. And Chris McDaniel is running on a commitment to balance the budget. Of course, every Republican talks about balancing the budget. It's one of the fundamental pillars of what it supposedly means to be a Republican. But here you got someone that actually is trying to do it, and you've seen that with this new class. I view it as the same kind of shakeup that Ronald Reagan did when he primaried a sitting Republican president in 1976. It was predicted then by the GOP establishment that would be the end of the GOP's competitiveness in national politics. Of course, the opposite happened, and Reagan very much seeded a revival, not just of the ideas of liberty and fiscal responsibility, but in Republican prospects in national elections.
But who's your Reagan this time? Not Dave Brat, presumably.
No, I think the beauty of what's going on today is that it's in many ways a leaderless movement. And you're seeing a whole new generation of young, interesting, energetic, ideas-based Republicans. And I would point to the primary field in 2016 as a great example of that. You start with Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Scott Walker and Marco Rubio, and the people that will likely emerge in that race all are the new generation. They're not the same people by any means, and they would disagree on a lot of issues, but you're talking about people with ideas.
Mark in Madison, Virginia. Eric Cantor's Dave Brat State. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great points today. I think one thing I hadn't heard much about was the impact of redistricting. In Madison, we were actually in Eric Cantor's district, and then we were redistricted out. The current district, now that extends through Madison, is Robert Hertz district. It goes all the way from the southern border of the state of Virginia almost up to northern Virginia, over 200 miles, very skinny little district now. And I'm seeing this pattern across the country of one-party control of the redistricting process, which then gives power to, I think, an inordinate amount of power to a small base and is influencing the electoral process. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Mark, let us pick it up. Nancy Curtis, I don't know how close you are to the actual lines of redistricting in Virginia, but that is a long, skinny district that Eric Cantor represented. Is it possible that with all his standing in the party, he lost out just on drawing lines here that went against him, Nancy?
It's possible, although I think, you know, no matter how you draw the lines in central and southern Virginia, you're going to come up with pretty heavily Republican districts. I think, it may be more of a case that he lost touch with his district to some extent. He had never really faced a difficult primary, so he didn't really have to worry about that. He had a lot of work that he was doing in Washington as the number two Republican in the House. He traveled internationally quite a bit. He went to Davos. He interacted with world leaders. He traveled to raise money for other Republicans and perhaps didn't realize that his standing was falling to some degree in his own district. And his own pollsters just a week or two before the race told him he was going to win by something like 34 points. So I suppose you can't blame him for assuming that he was going to walk away with the race this time.
But I'm reading here from public policy polling, 72% of voters in Cantor's district support bipartisan immigration reform. But to our caller's point, not those who came out. Matt Kibbe says have a singular message, a differentiated message in the 2016 race. That's the way for Republicans. What about it, Nancy? Is this a help or a hurt? A lot of Democrats were, appeared to be celebrating in the last 12, 18 hours as this news came out, thinking this will make it harder for the GOP. How do you see it?
Well, Democrats are delighted. In fact, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee just put out a release saying the takeaway is clear and unanimous. The inmates are running the asylum of this Republican Congress. Cantor's loss cements the dysfunction that has paralyzed this Congress and blocked ideas to help the middle class. So Democrats love any storyline that pits one wing of the Republican Party against the other, but the fact is that the party as a whole still has energy on its side, and that's something that Democrats have been struggling to drum up among their own supporters. So, you know, even if Republicans are still sort of hashing out where their party is going to be, they still have grassroots engagement and excitement, and that's going to serve them well in November. What it means for 2016, that's a different story.
Matt Kibbe, your ties go to the Tea Party. We were talking with Reform Conservatives here last week. As I said, Yuval Levin, Peter Winter, and more. What about that movement? It was tied to Eric Cantor. What does this loss say to Reform Conservatives?
Well, I happen to consider myself a Reform Conservative, and I suppose it means it depends what you mean by the definition of that. I think if you look at the people that we've helped bring to Washington since 2010, it really represents the ideas wing of the GOP. Plans to balance the budget, plans to reform Obamacare have come from the Mike Lees of the Republican Party, and we'll continue to push that.
And we're talking Tea Party wing, feeling pretty good today with Eric Cantor out in a huge upset out of his district in Virginia. Matt Kibbe, president and CEO of FreedomWorks. Thank you for joining us today, Matt.
Thank you.
And Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, always on top of it. Nancy, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR on Twitter. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.